What's up, everybody? Welcome to Apollineering. My name is Seth. Today we have a special guest with us. I'm super excited about this interview. So today's topic is going to be atheism, and we're going to dive into some of those questions that come along with that discussion. So I'm super excited to have Mark on. He is gracious enough to lend some time and discuss some questions that I have in particular. I know it's easy to get bogged down in some of the debate that goes on and things like that. So hopefully he'll be able clear some of that stuff up. I, as you guys know, Apollineering is a place for people to share their testimony, who have come out of certain beliefs and different religions and backgrounds to saving faith in Jesus Christ. And I want that to be the focus of this. I want, with that testimonial becomes a passionate life to expose the darkness. And so I've given people a platform to do that, to share what Jesus has done and what they're continuing to do for the kingdom. So, Apollineering is all about getting truth to you guys. It's about answering questions that you have on different beliefs and on different subjects, on different faiths. And I hope that you guys are taking that away from these videos. And if you haven't checked out some of my other ones, I encourage you to do so. I've covered a plethora of topics over the recent past. So without further ado, I want to introduce Mark, let him share his testimony, and then we'll just have a great discussion. So Mark Bauerlein earned his doctorate in English at UCLA in 1988. He has taught at Emory since 1989 with a 2.5-year break in 2003 to 2005 to serve as the director, Office of Research and Analysis at the National Endowment for the Arts. Apart from his scholarly work, he publishes in popular periodicals such as the Wall Street Journal, the Weekly Standard, the Washington Post, TLS, and Chronicle of Higher Education. His latest book, The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30, was published in May 2008. He recently co-edited a collection of essays entitled The State of the American Mind, 16 Leading Critics on the New Anti-Intellectualism, which was published in 2015. So, Mark, how are you, man?
Not bad.
Good.
I mean, things are, we're living in a time, we're living interesting times, and everything's up in the air. If you, yep. I live in Washington, D.C. now, inside the Beltway, so it's a little crazy here.
Yeah.
These days, in ways it hasn't been before. But, I spoke at a college campus last year, Wesleyan University, and very heavy, anti-Trump.
Right, yeah.
Powerfully so. And I said, apart from whatever you feel about Donald Trump, all you guys realize you're 20 years old, you just really experienced fully your first election.
Right.
And this is going to go down in history, in American history, as one of the most extraordinary political events ever.
Yeah.
And you came to maturity right in the middle of it. It's extraordinary what happened, that Donald Trump actually won on November 8th, 2016.
Right.
Is unthinkable. 2 years before then, if you said Donald Trump's our next president, people would call yeah, a madhouse, because they think you were certifiable.
Right.
But here we are. And who would have thought, to bring it back to some religious questions, who would have thought that Donald Trump, the 1980s Manhattan playboy,
right,
the guy with the life that he's led, should end up being one of the greatest defenders of religious liberty in our entire country's history?
Wow. Gosh, that's a bold statement.
Well, here's why I say that. First of all, if Hillary Clinton had been elected, then my church, the Catholic Church, and many other churches, evangelical churches, Orthodox Jewish religious organizations, would have had to hire many, many lawyers.
Oh, yeah.
Because Hillary would have turned the arm of the federal government against institutions that did not go along with the sexual revolution and the progressivist identity agenda. And they would have tried to shut them down.
Wow.
And which was happening under Barack Obama's administration. And Donald Trump has instituted offices of religious liberty in Health and Human Services and the Department of Justice. He's put out new regulations and guidelines telling federal workers that they must observe the conscience exemption. And we're not going to have anything under Trump's administration like we had under the Obama administration when they brought the Little Sisters of the Poor right into the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And they want, we're going to fine them and try to put them out of business.
Yeah.
Even though these are people who devote their lives to great suffering and relieving the poorest among us, they end up in the Supreme Court sued by the federal government because they won't provide contraception and abortifacients for their own employees. Donald Trump said, this isn't going to happen under my administration. And so it's ironic, right? To think that Donald Trump would end up being so, not only that, but extremely pro-life as well.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of unexpected twists and turns taking place here in Washington, D.C. and rippling out across the country regarding religion, discrimination, religious liberty. And we feel that, you know, people who are traditional believers in biblical understanding of things, we got a 4-year reprieve. Now, I don't know. You know, I don't know what's going to happen after this, but we got a little bit of time when Donald Trump got elected.
Yeah. Gosh, you're so right. We do live in such interesting times. And speaking of turning of events, man, I kind of want, I want you to explain why you even care about this, because I think there was a point in your life, at least from what I've read about you and what I've watched about you, there was a point in your life when you could have cared less about religion and stuff like that. So can you go into some of your history there and how you came to care about these kinds of topics and why you're so passionate about it now?
It's worse than that, Seth. I believed exactly what the new atheists believed. I believed what Christopher Hitchens believed when he said, God is not great. You know, religion ruins everything.
Yeah.
For 35 years, I was a confirmed secular militant atheist. I thought religious people were stupid or deluded, perhaps because they didn't have the courage to face the prospect of death and suffering and loss, and that I was one of Nietzsche's atheist foot soldiers who had the cold eye and intelligence to see the reality of an all material world. And I believed this starting when I was about age 17. And it ran into my early 50s, in fact. And it stopped. I was confirmed in my religion of nihilism. And I'm calling it a religion because it had all the force of a metaphysical certainty. And it was existential in that it wasn't even really even a thought through, reasoned out conviction. It was more a matter of, I felt it in my bones.
Yeah.
You know, it was fundamental.
Yeah.
In that regard.
Wow. That's powerful. So can you said you started at 17. What happened up until that point? How did you grow up? What kind of family? Did you grow up going to church and something happened and you kind of fell away? Or did your parents believe that? Or what happened up until 17 that made you so anti-God?
Well, That's a deep, probably a deep psychological question beyond my complete understanding. But yeah. my brother and I were baptized Catholics. I have a twin brother. And my parents grew up in Catholic schools. They were firm Catholics until about the time we were born. And the 60s came along and they got caught up in a lot of the 60s. They stopped going to church when we were toddlers. Mm-hmm. My sister went through her first communion. She was 4 years older than we were. She went to Catholic schools for several years. But by the time we were that age, they'd lost their, they'd lost certainly, the, I don't know, I wouldn't say they lost their faith, but they didn't like the church anymore. I think they were part of a generation in the 60s that simply came to regard the church as backward, as uptight, as not willing to go along with the liberation.
Right.
The sexual liberation that was taking place in the 60s. And look, let's face it, for the Catholic Church, the 60s and 70s are going to go down as one of the worst times in the entire two millennia of the church, of the existence of the church. I mean, look at what happened, how from 1955 to 1975, where did all the nuns go?
Right.
They just disappeared. Yeah. All the nuns were gone.
Right.
The Catholic schools were all taught by nuns. You had priests who were principals, administrators, but the nuns ran the school. Mm-hmm. And they were the ones closely involved with those students. And I kind of miss the days of those classrooms where all the desks were screwed into the floor and the nuns were walking up and down the aisle with a ruler in their hand. can we go back to that?
You want to do that because you're the professor now, huh?
I've fantasized myself, playing that role many times. But so I think that I grew up without any religious formation. God had no institutional backing.
Right.
We would go to church once a couple times a year, maybe, right. But it didn't mean anything. And when I was a teenager, we lived outside Washington, D.C. in the Maryland suburbs. We went to one of these churches built in the late, the 60s. Mm-hmm. This horrible architecture that they used to build churches, Catholic churches, in the mid-20th century. No sublimity to it. It didn't look much different from a rec center, with some crosses in
right.
it. So there was nothing holy about this dwelling space. This was not a temple in which you felt like you were going out of the world.
Interesting.
And I think part of the disaster of the 60s for the church was that it took the road of aligning with the world. The guitar wow. masses and the loosening up on so much doctrine. And what happens when institutions lose their confidence in their distinctiveness and they start imitating other institutions in the culture, secular wow. institutions, they lose the flock.
Right, yeah.
If I can get here by turning on the TV, why go?
Right, yeah. That's such a good point.
I'll tell you, I came back into the church in St. Vincent Ferrer, which was in New York City. It's in Manhattan. It's on Lexington and East 64th. And you walk into this church, it's a beautiful church inside. It has the elevation, the stained glass windows, high mass, it's dark, but it's very ornate. There's a ton of incense. Oh, they burned the smoke in there, and they I loved it.
Yeah.
The ritual, the trappings of the liturgy were not just trappings. They contributed to the holiness of the space and what was going on in there. And that has to be done. Mm-hmm. And that's for me. That's what I think.
Yeah.
Other churches, you know, evangelical churches, mega churches, they really depend upon the charisma,
right,
of the message and the messenger, right? The man or woman on stage. Mm-hmm. And that can be very powerful.
Yeah.
The Catholic liturgy and the homily by the Catholic priest usually doesn't have very much charisma to it.
Yeah.
Right? But that's because the emphasis is elsewhere.
Right.
It is on the readings. It is on the procession, the recession. It is on the ritual. The priest has work to do up there at the altar.
Right.
And lining up for communion, that's, and I like all the incense, that's what matters,
right,
in the Catholic liturgy. And that appealed to me. I did go to different churches, and this is part of what grabbed me about the Catholic Church.
Yeah. So what was your view of God growing up, kind of going to this Catholic school, and you view him as a personal figure now, but it sounds like when you were growing up, he seemed to be some impersonal, dictator that ruled, supposedly ruled from heaven and thwarted all of mankind and wanted to trick them. I mean, what was your view of God as a person, or did you have a view of God as a person?
You know, I sort of looked upon God a little more abstractly as some kind of supreme being.
Yeah.
Right? More of a force than an identity. Because, again, I didn't have any institutional presentation of God, and I didn't read the Bible. We didn't do any of that at home. It wasn't part of my schooling. So I just went to secular, public schools.
Right, yeah.
And For me, and just at a certain point, one day I just woke up and looked around and said, there's no God. There's nothing here. Wow. Nothing's going on. There's nothing out there. There's no spirit in the world. Hmm. It's just gone. It was just gone.
Interesting.
That's why I talk about it as sort of a religious experience that hit me, and it was holistic, right? It changed everything. The whole universe was different.
Yeah.
Now, it was meaningless, purposeless, spiritless. Mm-hmm. It was all just gone. And then that's why there was just God was gone, and nothing. Mm-hmm. It was nothing.
So how did you live your life after that? I mean, if you wake up just one day, like you described it, as it just kind of holistically hit you, and how did you decide to live your life? I mean, what kind of morals were you ascribing to? How did you describe morality? What was the purpose of your life? Or did you just, why did you think we were here?
No reason. There's no reason why we're here.
Wow.
The morality around us, I could say I could be a more or less good person, but to ascribe any of my goodness to anything more than my own will, I took as just superstition and stupidity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As well. And to believe that there was any moral content to out there, right? That there is something like natural law or natural rights. I saw that as, the man in the moon.
Yeah.
That was Santa Claus.
Right.
So when I read the New Atheists, I know exactly what they think, why they think it. That voice is very familiar
to
me.
Yeah.
And I actually, well, when I read them today, I just find them boring. You know, I mean, I find them adolescent, in fact. And that was what I was. I was adolescent myself. And this happens to a lot of teenagers, I think.
Yeah.
They become little nihilists. Mm-hmm. You know, they read a little Nietzsche. And they get caught up in this idea of irreverence, and you can be a little ironic about things, and you think that it's an achievement. Mm-hmm. You really feel superior to people of faith. There's a great deal of self-compliment that you find among atheists. I mean, they think they're so smart.
Right.
You know, they think they're disillusioned, but they regard it as an achievement because they've stepped out of illusion. Mm. I'm no longer deluded by false ideas. Mm. And I'll give myself a little pathos by saying, I don't have false hopes either, and so it's sometimes tougher to live that way, but that ennobles them in their own eyes.
Yeah.
And the contempt, the condescension they have for ordinary believers is only satisfying to other people who think the same way. Hmm. And I don't think it doesn't last. I mean, Christopher Hitchens' book, God Is Not Great. Is anyone going to read that in 20 years?
Wow, that's true.
You know, these atheist books, they had their moment. Well, read Nietzsche. Nietzsche's going to be around forever. Mm-hmm. But for one thing, Nietzsche had a sense of humor about himself. Mm. Whereas the new atheists, and a lot of atheists, take themselves way too seriously. they're very caught up in their own... in their own grandiosity.
Yeah.
And Nietzsche was all, Nietzsche had his grandiosity, yes. But there was always a little bit of humor, and he had a way of putting things that would make you laugh. You know, he said the only person who is deserving of any respect in the entire Bible, the Old and New Testament, is Pontius Pilate. Now, why did he say that? Because Pilate is the great ironist. He washes his hands of the whole affair. I'm above all this. Oh, yeah. These stupid little quibbles between these religious nutcases, wow, causing trouble. Oh, please, you guys, just take your squabble somewhere else. Don't bother me. You know, I wash my hands.
Right.
So right. That's the figure. That's the ironist who elevates himself above, not just outside of, but above the people with petty convictions squabbling with one another.
Right. That's interesting. And so you said earlier that you were a militant atheist. What does that mean? How are you, were you attacking other faiths? What happened? Why would you describe your faith as, or your past faith as that?
Because I wouldn't give religious belief any quarter. Hmm. Flat wrong. Stupid. Zip.
Yeah.
I don't need to read any of it. I don't need to know anything more about it. I see through all of the illusions that you entertain, and I'm not going to argue with you over it. Mm-hmm. I don't argue with children. That's what I meant by militant.
Okay.
Just in my own attitudes.
Yeah.
I didn't waste time in writing books against faith because I didn't feel like I had to.
Right.
These people are going away pretty soon. Religious faith is on its way out.
Interesting.
And I'm in academia. I mean, Seth, I was in the humanities.
Yeah.
At research universities, which are strongly secular places.
Yes, they are.
I mean, if you want to see a nasty form of condescension, just ask a women's studies professor what she thinks of an evangelical, that evangelical person, student over there. You know, ask that English professor what he thinks of the people in Indiana who go in the Catholic Church and have communion. Uh-huh. Well, what are you talking about, this stupid, you know, body and blood stuff?
Yeah.
So I was surrounded by that. And so why am I going to bother taking on arguments against faith? Mm. Faith is out. It's not. Yeah. It was not part of my life at all. And I joined in with the general mockery of fervent believers. Mm. That was easy.
Yeah.
And here's the funny thing. It's a lot harder to believe in God than not to believe in God. That's what I think.
Wow. Yeah.
I think harder to maintain belief than it is to slide into unbelief. I mean, that was my experience.
Yeah. Wow. That's interesting.
And people who believe that faith in God is easy, they just don't know.
Yeah.
They don't know about the struggles that God burdens you with.
Wow.
You have to live with, one, you have to live with God's judgment.
Yeah.
You have to accept original sin, which I regard as the first piece of human wisdom. The first piece of divine wisdom that we can, metaphysical wisdom for us to have, is in Proverbs. You know, the beginning of wisdom is fear of the Lord.
Right.
That's where it starts.
Right.
And if you don't have that and you don't believe in original sin, you have no wisdom.
Yeah.
Okay.
I agree. I completely agree with that, because, and it's so true. I mean, we hear it all the time, and you know, I've spent a fair amount of time in the academic world, and, you know, here at my job, we mentor students in their senior design classes. So I'm actually still involved in that, but I see that as being like, faith is just a cheap way out of, you know, of accepting the reality of the world. When in fact, like you were just describing, it's like one of the hardest things, because, you know, if you don't ascribe to the morality preached by Jesus, then you really have no morals to upkeep other than the laws of the civil laws of the land. And so, you know, you can sleep with whoever you want, you can do, you know, whatever you want to whoever you want, but it's harder to be a Christian. It's harder to live a moral life. It's harder to live for Jesus, especially in our society today when we're being ostracized by everyone, you know, and it's hard to treat people with respect and to understand where they're coming from and their ignorance almost, because it, you know, just you describing what's going on in the neo-atheists and all that kind of stuff, they're just ignorant. They don't know. They've never taken the time, like you said, to read anything or to look into it a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, there are, as Nietzsche put it, there are metaphysical comforts.
Yeah.
That come from faith.
Yeah.
And I will say that when I was coming back into the church, I found, even before I was in the church, I found a great satisfaction to go sit in a pew in the back, in the dark, and just sit there. That was soothing to me. It was that out of the world experience, and I know I don't belong here, not really, but this is an appealing spot right here. You know, I did a piece at First Things once when a lot of students were calling for more safe spaces on college campuses.
Right.
And so what I did was I did a series of pictures from the campuses of Duke University and Yale and about a dozen other universities. And I just showed a picture of the chapel. There's your safe space.
Wow.
You can go inside anytime you want and nobody is going to bother you. Hmm. You're going to find peace and quiet and solitude And you can pray or you can not pray, but the chapel on campus is your haven. This is where you can go mm-hmm. for metaphysical comfort. So faith does provide that, but a whole bunch of burdens and obligations and self-examinations go along with it.
Right.
The first point to go along with fear of the Lord and original sin for me is whatever grace comes my way, I do not deserve.
Wow.
I don't, and I profoundly believe that.
Yeah.
I don't deserve this.
Right.
This is not what comes from above is so far beyond anything that I could possibly earn on my own that I accept it as pure gift. And if I get anything, I'm very lucky. But I never make the mistake of thinking, yeah, I deserve this.
Wow.
I earned it.
Yeah.
No, none of us earn it. Nope. We are all creatures. We are all fallen.
Right.
And what the Creator decides for us is right.
I think that is such a healthy view to have because it, you know, it's just as Paul describes, because it without accepting the fact that we don't deserve it, we're able to like build up that pride within us based on like what we do or what we say that, oh, wow, you know, I did this today, so I deserve more grace from God today, or I did that yesterday, so I don't deserve as much grace today. When in fact, it's outside of that, right? It's outside of what we do or we don't do, that grace is just that gift that God has granted us outside of our works, lest we boast, correct?
And I find that humility is a great relief.
Yeah.
I have no problem. In fact, I court that kind of humility that comes from sitting in the back in the pew and just in a way just being quiet for a time.
So how did you go from this, you know, militant atheism to believing again? Like, what was the tipping point? What events led up to that?
There, you know, there wasn't really any tipping point. It was a slow process. Having a child is one thing. Saying to myself, looking at my 3-year-old child and saying, do I want him to grow up to be an atheist?
Wow.
Do I want him to and I said, no. I said to myself, no, I don't want that for him. He'll make up his own mind when he's an adult. But now I want to bring him up in the church. I want him to receive a religious education. Mm-hmm. And even if only for cultural reasons, but I want it to be more than that. That told me there's something wrong here. Right? There's something wrong with the atheism. Another thing was just being around some people who were believers who were very smart. I spent a year at Princeton and got to know someone who'd been familiar with some things I'd written. And so he sort of made a friend of me, and I liked him very much. And he was Opus Dei. Mm. And he said, look, why don't we just go through the Catholic Catechism, that big, thick, 700-page book.
Yeah.
Let's just go through it. And I said, okay. And I
it's
almost
an easy endeavor.
Well, I almost looked at it as a course. Oh, okay, I'll take a class in this.
Yeah.
Well, we started going through it. We did an hour a week. We went through the whole thing. Mm. And it wasn't too far into it before I said, you know, this is very intelligent. It's quite sophisticated for me ever to have regarded this as low IQ stuff.
Wow.
Was just a fatuous conception.
Yeah.
And talking with him as well, very smart man, a lawyer, really did sort of intellectually draw me in and persuade me with good arguments. And it took time, but over the course, I was swayed into thinking that my deep convictions about nihilism are mistaken. I couldn't quite get rid of them. They're inside me and they're going to stay there.
Yeah.
But I regard them as error.
Wow.
And that they really had more to do with, you know, the circumstances when I was 17 years old and being a, you know, confused adolescent, that they were almost a psychological response.
Yeah.
To things happening.
Wow.
At that time. And so now I believe, you know, in my head, I believe in the faith, and I am firm about what I read in the catechism. We went through the whole thing. It took us about 3 years. And even after I moved away from Princeton, we did it over the phone. And we still, we've now gone into the books of the Ignatius Study Bible. And we've done some of the Gospels. We did Acts. Now we're going to start to do the book of Romans. And the education is proceeding.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it was really, while when I was young, my slide into atheism was this sudden experiential thing. My withdrawal from it has been more of an educational, intellectual process. Fueled by my feeling that, nah, what happened back then was wrong. It was off. And again, it was a psychological resolution, you know, to things going on in my life instead of an apprehension of the truth.
Right.
No, it wasn't.
So when you were living this lifestyle, how did you explain supernatural events? What, you know, especially today, there's more like, especially like in cinema and movies and Hollywood, that seems like there's this focus on like supernatural, almost like, for instance, Doctor Strange. I don't know if you're into the Marvel universe or anything, but that's such a supernatural movie, talking about, you know, this hidden force, you know, behind the secret, you know, physical realm that we can see. So how did you view this type of stuff that happened around the world, or that people claim to have happened? What would you say it was?
The mind can do a lot of crazy things. People can make themselves certain about anything. That's how I looked at it.
Yeah.
And dealing with distressing or horrifying events, the death of a loved one, it's a lot nicer to believe that that loved one is in another place and existing in some capacity, that these emanations of the supernatural are psychological projections of our desires. That's how I would look at it.
Wow.
And the pressure is very strong for people who have suffered to believe in a rationale for that suffering. And to believe that the universe is a moral place. It's not just a neutral, alien, cold world that we occupy. It's hard to believe that life doesn't matter. Your own individual existence is nothing. It's a speck of sand. That's not easy to accept.
Yeah.
And so against that pressure, people can imagine all kinds of things.
Wow.
And get over it.
Yeah. So I kind of want to transition now into some of the arguments that you may have had when you were an atheist. You said that when you were going through the catechism with your friend at Princeton, that he answered some questions that you had had. So what kinds of questions did you have? What kinds of things could you not, you know,
well, when
describe? Or
when the catechism says early on that God is, in so many words, God is written into the human heart. That struck me because it said, okay, people believe in God. Where does this come from? Where does this come from? Do they just imagine it? Do they invent it? But so many people have believed in God, and so many very intelligent people have. This seems like a more convincing explanation than, well, they're afraid and they just imagine God as a Santa Claus who's going to take care of them. Or is it, no, God has written the aspiration toward him into the human heart? That, to me, I think that's a better explanation than the cynical one. To me, it clicked.
Wow.
So that would be one example.
Okay. All right. Well, that makes sense.
Of faith.
Yeah.
And the catechism acknowledges these desires, these needs. It acknowledges human frailty, and it orients us toward a God who cares. And the way it oriented us toward him didn't impress me as delusional. It sounded to me like a long, careful process of intelligent people working out ideas and realities. And it gave me the humility to say to myself, who am I? The church has 2,000 years of very smart people putting together a body of ideas and doctrine and liturgies. Who do I think I am to say it's all false?
Yeah.
That's quite a bit of chutzpah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh gosh, that just, I think, tells so much about who you are as a person. You know, just outside of the fact that you were an atheist, you still like gave your, you know, you had humility enough to admit something like that, because from the videos I've watched of, you know, people claiming to be atheists and there's the hatred that they have and the lack of, you know, compassion that exists inside them towards other human beings is almost like demonic in its origin, because they have no desire to have that humility and that introspection and to take a second look at themselves and figure out why they really, you know, haven't looked into what they need to look into. So that kind of transitions. Oh, sorry. What were you going to say?
They don't seem to show a great deal of human generosity.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You're so right. And I've noticed that as well. And so that kind of transitions into my next question was, what sort of tips would you give us in witnessing to atheists and in sharing the gospel with them and sharing the good news? What would you have liked to have seen differently in your life when you were living that way, or what can we do?
I think that religious believers need to take on atheists. Battle them. You do have a few of them fighting back. David Bentley Hart, writing against the atheists. But we need more religious people to take apart Sam Harris and other irreverent figures.
Yeah.
And to do so on a variety of grounds. Moral grounds, metaphysical grounds, philosophical grounds, logical grounds, historical grounds.
Wow.
I mean, some people have shown Dawkins knows nothing about the history of the church. Mm. I mean, his examples are things that you'd find in an undergraduate sophomore class.
On
secularism. So take them on and say, this is a battle. It's an intellectual battle. It's an institutional battle.
Yeah.
There are young atheists out there who need to hear strong, firm voices in the church. We need some Christian soldiers out there to not just formal debates, but write essays without being challenged. Go ahead and write essays challenging them.
Wow. Yeah.
Don't be reactive, be proactive.
Yeah.
Against the atheists in this world. Don't be defensive, go on the offensive.
Wow.
So that's what I would say.
Yeah, well that's powerful because it does seem like Christians are always on the defensive. It never seems like there's people.
I'm tired of it.
Yeah, one guy that I can think of is Dinesh D'Souza, and I think he's done a good job of going into the universities and sharing the faith and sharing the truth of history, of the church, of Jesus, you know. And I think Lee Strobel, as I'm sure you're aware, did a good job in his book, The Case for Christ, debunking some of the claims that atheists make towards Jesus and his resurrection and the gospels and things like that. So I love that you said that because it's so true. And I have a personal desire to do that and I need to do it once I get the time, but
let's target the atheists.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they've targeted us. Let's target them.
Yeah. So that kind of leads to my next question. What are you writing essays or what are you doing to combat this faith that you used to claim?
Well, I work at First Things magazine and we're a religious magazine and we're acting out of biblical truths and applying them to what's going on in the world
right
today. So that's a big part of my life. That's one of my jobs. In my teaching, I teach courses, and when I teach American literature, I do a lot of reference to the King James Bible, which is the most important book in all of American history. Hmm. And I tell all the students, you got to read King James. You have to read the Gospels. You have to read Genesis. You should read some Leviticus with the Ten Commandments.
Yeah.
The book of Job, you need to read the Psalms, you need to read Proverbs, and you need to read Paul's letters.
Yeah.
All of you, you need to read this.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, you're a lesser human being. That's what I tell them. And I've actually told students before, you really need to go to church. You should go to church.
Yeah.
And I don't worry about someone saying, you're proselytizing. I said, well, you know, feminists proselytize too.
Jeez, yeah.
No one gets mad at them for doing
it. Yeah,
we can do it too.
Yeah, no, that's so true. You know, this channel is dedicated to, really, I want to get the gospel to people, and that's my whole purpose in doing this is showing, you know, where people have come from and because everyone's story is differently. And so there's so many religions out there. Do you find it important to study these other religions and to be able to have a basic understanding of them in order to share the gospel more effectively?
Coming into the church so late as I did and not having a real religious education, sectarian differences don't matter that much to me. I mean, I just don't know enough to take sectarian differences all that strongly.
Yeah.
My son right now is in a Lutheran school.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine with me.
Yeah.
So I can't say, and I find that Jews and Muslims and Christians have a lot of common ground, particularly in that the traditional ones tend to be social conservatives.
Mm.
And right now, the aggression is coming from the secular world. And we need to insist upon first the centrality of God in our understanding of ourselves and our world and our laws and everything else.
Yeah.
And that's the first task.
Yeah.
Right now, fighting the wave of secular religion. And let's get back to a healthier God religion.
Yeah. 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 And gosh, that's so good. So I know your time is valuable. I kind of want to end today's conversation just on that note of spreading the gospel and getting the truth out to people and creating the ground to have conversation, because it's so easy to let our pride get up. It's so easy to let our defenses get up that we forget to love people around us. And, you know, just in my personal experience, I find it so important to show that agape love to someone who doesn't believe what I believe, because that's going to create that relationship. That's going to draw them towards you to have that deeper conversation in the future. And, you know, it's also super important to be led by the Holy Spirit, because, you know, Jesus promised that the Holy Spirit would give us words when we don't know what to say. So, you know, Mark challenged us today to have those debates with atheists, to go on the offensive. And even if you don't know what to say, the Holy Spirit's going to give you those words to speak. He's going to empower you to understand where they're coming from. He's going to give you knowledge. He can do those types of things. And so if you're struggling with talking to someone, or maybe you're struggling with having the boldness or the courage to say, just do it. Like, I encourage you to just do it and see what the Lord can do through you. Because he's called each one of us to make disciples and to go out and occupy the earth until he comes again. So, I want to end on that note. And Mark, I thank you so much for your time today. Is there anything you'd like to add before we close?
I would ask everyone to make a habit of reading from the Bible every night.
Wow! Yeah,
just it's a ritual. It's a little thing you do. One page, just some scriptural reading each night is a healthy thing to do.
Gosh, I completely agree with you, and gosh, that's such good advice. So. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in today. We'll catch you on the next episode. And you know the saying, don't be lazy, do the research.